The evidence of the last four centuries is that financial innovation and intensity regularly breeds debt and credit crises, burst bubbles, and the like. In his still unsurpassed 1978 study, Manias, Panics, and Crashes, Charles Kindleberger listed two dozen between 1720 and 1974 to 1975. Their parenthood was principally Dutch, British, and later American, because these nationalities dominated global finance, central banking, markets, and trade during those years. The first modern financial mania collapsed in 1720, the South Seas bubble, and the most recent, the high-tech NASDAQ bubble, splattered between 2000 and 2002. If human nature has changed, the gene modification must have occurred almost overnight. The economists who called Greenspan a serial bubbler or condemned him for throwing money supply or debt expansion at every crisis had documentation. Tabulations of M3, the broadest major money supply measurement, showed a mushrooming from $4 trillion to $7 trillion between the early 1990s and the millennium as Greenspan lubricated crises involving Mexican debt, Russian debt, Asian currencies, the collapse of long-term capital management, and Y2K fears. The Fed chairman's legitimate rebuttal rested on his responsibility for the safety of the banking system, although he discharged it well beyond any clear mandate in protecting non-bank linchpins, such as long-term capital management, the large wayward hedge fund on behalf of which Greenspan helped arrange a Wall Street bailout in 1998. Indeed, the quarter century before 2005 could be described as a triumph of financial sector protection over marketplace comeuppance. The principal U.S. governmental interventions, resuscitations, and rescue missions, high-level influence was a given and huge dollops of money commonplace, were used to preserve financial sector interests and institutions. In the early 1980s, as these bailouts were getting underway, debate raged in Washington over a national industrial policy or strategy. That objective, originating with high technology companies, was for Washington to support U.S. firms against the mercantilist alliances of business and government prevalent in Europe, Latin America, and Asia. Otherwise, said U.S. executives, American manufacturers would lose more global markets. Conservative office holders and theorists generally disagreed, insisting that Washington should not pick winners. However, by the end of the century, it became clear that the federal government had done exactly that, picking finance to be the ascendant sector in the U.S. economy, and figuratively shrugging as American manufacturing lost its markets, profits, and prime political access. The electorate, of course, never got to vote on a decision that never had to be made formally. The financial sector, in fact, was already the statutorily designated constituency of Washington's second most powerful officeholder, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, whose mandate was to supervise and regulate banks, implement monetary policy, and maintain a strong official payment system. Here, the reader may want to turn back to Chapter 6, with its portrait of how U.S. manufacturing slid and finance took control, staking the American future on a sector with no record of sustaining earlier global economic hegemonies. The Federal Reserve Board was the principal architect. So backstopped, the ascendant financial sector enjoyed the best of two seemingly contradictory worlds. On one hand, the Federal Reserve Board and sometimes the Treasury Department were available to rescue banks, bondholders, critical currencies, and even hedge funds too big to fail. Yet at the same time, the financial services industry enjoyed the accumulating benefit of three decades of deregulation, minimal regulatory constraint. This triumph of neo-laissez-faire, as we will see, was almost as important as the government bailouts. Deregulation of financial services had been underway since 1980, but by the late 1990s, the industry was like a long-distance runner coming down onto the flats for the last mile. The finish line, the promise of nearly unfettered financial capitalism and devil take the hindmost, was so close the panting chief executives could see it.